Good afternoon, everyone. This is Hunt Tooley, and I should say good afternoon or good morning or good evening or whenever it is that you listen to this or watch it. And I am teaching a course on totalitarians at the Mises Academy of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And we have today the seventh in a series of 8 weeks. We have worked our way through a lot of material, an awful lot of material so far, and we have quite a bit to go. We've talked a lot about omnipotent government. We've talked a lot about the theoretical and historical background to totalitarianism. We've gone in pretty careful detail into the German prehistory to totalitarianism, and especially what Mises said about it in Omnipotent Government. We've talked about World War I and the extent to which World War I was a kind of precursor and dry run in some ways for totalitarianism as it emerged after the war. We worked through the lives of Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini, and some others too, Lenin as well, in some detail. And then the last time, the Sunday before Easter Sunday, we talked about the crimes of the total state. That could have expanded into several lectures itself, because you just can't fathom all the crimes that these total states have committed. But in the interest of getting through the course and getting through this material and keeping the framework in place, we made our way through it. So today, of course, we'll be talking, and the next time we'll be talking about more crimes of the total state, because frankly, it's just sort of a crime in and of itself. It's certainly the real expression of violence in the modern world, and has done far more violence on a world scale, as any counting would do, than just, say, ordinary street crime or anything like that. So we had to work today to do some comparing of total regimes, and I've got a way in to do that, and so let's begin. There it is, comparing the totalitarians, and so off we go. What I would like to do today, as I look out the windows to my office, we've had a few tornadoes around my part of North Texas lately, and it is growing a little bit dark. So if you see those books behind me begin to fly sideways or fly off the shelf or something, it's not any kind of, you know, witchcraft or magic or anything like that. It's not a sleight of hand. It's just the tornado passing through my office. But I think we're pretty safe in here. I'm in a building that was constructed in 1913, so I think we're good to go. So as we compare the totalitarians, what we'll look at is the structure of the state for just a little bit, and then we'll talk about economics and then some more crimes. I mean, we want to talk about a kind of comparative look at these crimes, because this is really important to us. And I might also say that our comparison will certainly flow into next week. Some things in today's discussion I had to cut out, because I really do want to have the full time for a discussion now that we're getting all of this material under our belts, and that you've all done reading and writing on all of this, and I want there to be some really effective discussion, both this week and next. So I shortened my presentation a bit before we started, so that it would be doable. So let's begin. There we have our Mussolini in the car with Hitler, Stalin washing his windshield. I really don't think that's what he's doing, although it looks like Stalin's washing his windshield in that photograph. But what I'd like to talk about for just a moment is something I started to mention last week, and so let me just jump right in. The fact of the matter is that the state structures in each of these regimes, these three big regimes that we've started to think about, or that we've studied, the state structure is has been a question for scholars, and it should be a very interesting question for us as people who are interested not only in the history of the individual and of liberty, but also in the history of intentionality and the way that people make choices in their lives as individuals and so forth. I'm going to talk more about this at the end in connection with crimes, but I just want to throw out at this point the idea that there has been a considerable debate on the extent to which Hitler was in fact a just a guy who came to power saying, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, this is all what I want to do, and this will all be planned out in advance, and we will simply carry out the Third Reich in this way. A more recent, as I mentioned in an earlier lecture, this is, in a sense, the earlier interpretation of Hitler in the post-war period. But in more recent times, in the last 20 or 25 years, more scholars have sort of moved over to a functionalist kind of interpretation. It really has its roots in some Marxian or at least institutionalist historians, even all the way back to the approach of this, all the way back to the 1920s. However, the idea itself is quite a useful one when thinking about and as a way of discussing the Nazi regime, in that we have various crimes, and we have the army marching into Poland and just declaring war on the Poles. And we have the whole SS apparatus aimed at killing all the Jews. We have the persecution of political minorities and all sorts of minorities. We have homosexuals rounded up and thrown into the camps. We have people, Jehovah's Witnesses, for goodness sake, who are a real threat in Hitler's eyes, and about two-thirds of German Jehovah's Witnesses were actually beheaded, had among the highest kill rates of any particular group. So there's all this kind of killing going on, but Hitler didn't do it. I mean, this is the real lesson of Étienne de la Boétie, as many of you know, in his book Involuntary Servitude. And when he says, well, why are we minions of the state? Why don't we just rise up and throw off the state? This issue has come up already in this course as we've discussed things, and it's an important issue to consider. But one of the ways that we can think about Nazi Germany is that there was a lot of kind of a functional bureaucratic aspect to this, so that the bureaucracy gained steam and carried out all kinds of desires of Hitler that he only had to sort of confirm with a wink and a nod. His top minions, as we know now, in particular Goebbels and Himmler, were people who were quite adept at thinking about the plans for the future Third Reich. They were quite adept at thinking about how to mobilize the masses, and they had folks under them who were also equally adept. So there's a whole structure here. And there are people who carry out the crimes of the total state because it's their job, and that's what they're paid to do. They're paid to be railway conductors and railway engineers, and when their trains are loaded up with people to go to Treblinka, then they just do it. So there's no Hitler out there carrying those people across country to the Operation Reinhardt camps. It's just simple, normal railroad employees. So anyway, there's this idea that a way of looking at the Third Reich in this sense of a more spread out responsibility. This leads to discussions of how many people in the Third Reich were complicit, were guilty, and this discussion also leads into a lot of issues that have to do with resistance to the state that are extremely extremely interesting. Many of the terrorists from the student movement period in German history, the Baader-Meinhof gang, these terroristic types were really basically, some of them in actual fact, the children of people who resisted Hitler, who reasoned, well, if this country is run by evil corporate magnates and political elites, then it's only moral to resist those as our parents did resist Hitler. So anyway, there's a bigger framework here, and the structure of the Nazi state is very, very, very interesting. We're going to talk a little bit about that later on. I think we could look at Italian corporatism in the same light, and we will in just a few moments. Thinking about the extent to which Mussolini's corporatism was really just real or imagined. I mean, it's a fact that Mussolini talked a good fight. I mean, in a way, as the inventor of the term totalitarianism, we just tend to give Mussolini more credit for being, or whatever that is, a blame for being a totalitarian when he was a lot more like many another garden variety brutal dictator, but not your totalitarian in that sense, but we'll talk about that in a second. And then finally, we come to Stalin and his state apparatus. Did everything happen because of Stalin? And I think that recent research has gone in a direction that's interesting and similar to what the research from Germany has gone in, and that is to say that a lot of scholars are looking at Stalin and saying, you know, this is like the most paranoid person who ever lived, but he also had limits to his power. And a famous poet in Russia wrote him a letter and said, well, but mass collectivization of the peasants is leading to thousands and thousands of death, and it's leading to torture, and the NKVD is taking away everything people have and starving them to death. And Stalin stops to write back and say, well, you know, this, you make a good point there, and I hate for these things to happen, but here's the thing, they're really guilty. I mean, so Stalin is actually justifying this and takes, in a way, takes the time, whether or not he takes this all that seriously, we don't know, but he takes the time, in this case and many, many others, to kind of talk about his policies. And so his minions sometimes say no. His minions sometimes, very rarely, but they sometimes say no. I would say not as often as Hitler's, but oftentimes they try to convince him to go in some different course. Usually he doesn't, but anyway, there's also the kind of Etienne de la Boetie argument here. You know, Stalin was what, 1 against 180 million, or if you take away loyal communists, 1 against what, 179 million. And so how could he be the total leader? There's got to be people complicit in that. There's got to be people cooperating. In fact, there have to be some fairly broad elites or sections of society that gain from that, that follow along in that path. So here's one way of thinking of these state structures, and we'll move on and talk about that in connection with crimes a little bit later. so I want to think here about a comparison now. It has to do with the structure of the state in this broad sense, but it also has to do with the attitudes of the total regimes toward individuals. The individual, of course, sinks to nothing in the total state. And I want to look at some approaches now on the part of three of our totalitarians, and work on that just a little bit. I found this is really interesting. Later in life, after Solzhenitsyn had gotten out of camp, he talked to Lazar Kogan, who had been one of the big state security gulag leaders. And Kogan said, I will to Solzhenitsyn, and by the way, that's a picture of Solzhenitsyn as a prisoner, or a Zek, as they call themselves. I believe that you personally were not guilty of anything. But as an educated person, you have to understand that social prophylaxis was being widely applied. Well, very widely applied, of course. That means that if somebody's guilty and you're a part of their class or group, then you too are guilty. That's called collective guilt in the Stalinist bag of tricks. And actually it's a principle that Stalin used more and more and more as time went on. You are if you're guilty, even more than in the purges at the end, before he died, he was lashing out right and left at groups of individuals because of what some other person in the group had done, and indeed eventually he would lash out at groups because of what someone in the group might do or would potentially do. So this all goes back to, I don't know, principles of Western civilization, principles of Judeo-Christian ethics, certainly principles of liberty and individual responsibility and individual security. In a sense, it goes, this idea of collective guilt goes against everything that's at the basis of the whole movement for the individual in Western civilization. Collective guilt. And therefore, if there is collective guilt, then what you do is carry out not just collective punishment, you certainly do that, but in advance you can carry out social prophylaxis in the Stalinist jargon. And that just means, I mean, you kill them before they do it. So, or put them in prison before they do it. Now, if you think about it, how ridiculous this principle, how laughable this would have sounded to somebody in the Western world in 1900, if you would consider that somebody would say, well, we need to imprison all these people because this one person did this, or even worse, because this one person might potentially do this, then you think about the extent to which now, 110, 112 years later, we actually, in the Western world, operate this way. We actually have people talking this way. We actually have a friend of mine who wrote a little memoir about her time as a German being family that was actually imprisoned in a concentration camp at the end of World War II by Polish people who were, you know, understandably angry at somebody, but I mean, they penned up this little 5-year-old girl in a concentration camp and kept her there for 5 years. But her crime was that she was a German. I mean, she hadn't done anything. How could a 5-year-old girl do anything? But she was guilty because of all the rest. Anyway, she gave a book signing talk in Germany, and a person, a woman who was an academic, stood up and said, "Well, you can't be a victim. You're a German. How can you? There's no such thing. We Germans can only be perpetrators. We can't be victims." So, this thing comes up. I mean, how many people in America are prejudged because of their group, because of what they might do, because of the speech they might say, or because of what their speech might suggest to someone? So, to tell you the truth, when we look at the status of the individual like this, it's a little bit scary. I mean, 25 years ago, even, we would have looked at this and said, oh man, that was terrible. I'm glad it's not that bad today, but you do have to ask yourself about the condition of our society. To continue on this point about the individual, Molotov, who was one of Stalin's most important henchmen throughout the whole thing, and I mean the whole damn life. He was certainly foreign secretary at the time of the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact, but long before that, he had been a very, very important henchman, and was one of the persons who carried out the artificial famine and helped create the artificial famine and the repression of the kulaks and the disaster for prosperous farmers or semi-prosperous farmers in all the various places in 1931, 32, 33. So here's Molotov later in life. It's an interview, and someone asks him about the purges now. He's really not talking about forced collectivization, although I assume he'd say the same thing, but the subject is the purges. And Molotov says, it's certainly sad that so many innocent people died during the purges, but I believe the terror of the late 1930s was necessary. And in a fairly long passage, he goes on to say, you know, this is the thing, we just didn't have time to look at everybody, and it was an emergency, and basically we just had to go with our instinct and kill them all. A bit reminiscent of this, the wiping out of the Cathars, and who was it, Philip, I forget which Philip, King of France, said, kill them all, God will know his own. And Molotov wouldn't say that, but certainly he takes that kind of tact. Well, you're going to lose a few in there some way. Here's another comment by Mussolini. I'm trying to find a thread here about the individual and what it means in totalitarian societies. The fascist conception of life stresses the importance of the state and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with the state. It is opposed to classical liberalism, which denied the state in the name of the individual. Fascism reasserts the rights of the state as expressing the real essence of the individual. The maxim that society exists only for the well-being and freedom of the individuals composing it does not seem to be in conformity with nature's plans. So much for Mussolini. But I mean, I'm pointing here to a kind of theoretical and systematic rejection of the individual as being dangerous for the state, which does in fact make it rather strange that in that all of our big three dictators, not Lenin, but Mussolini, Stalin, and Hitler, that they all created intensive cults of personality surrounding some version of their own individual self. So they could appear as individuals, and that was crucial to the state, but more like a kind of Leviathan embodiment of the state. You know, I thought also of Heinrich Himmler's famous Posen speech to SS leaders in 1943, and I won't read this. I'll read a little of it. He's given a long speech reporting on all kinds of events in the war to these SS leaders. It's in Posen. It's the rear area to the front, so they're all safe and sound. But all these SS people have been out on the front. And he says, now I come to another topic, and I want to mention it this one time in public, and then we shouldn't talk about it anymore. He says, I'm thinking now of the evacuation of the Jews, the extirpation of the Jewish people. It's one of those things that's easy to say. The Jewish people will be extirpated, says every party comrade. That's quite clear. It's in our program. Elimination of the Jews. Extirpation. That's what we're doing. And then they all come along, these 80 million good Germans, and every one of them has his decent Jew. You see, this individual who is good. What he's saying is that these kind of maudlin Germans, you know, the Germans are always romantics and sort of maudlin, and they come about and they still have this old-fashioned, old-timey idea that an individual has merits on the basis of what is in the individual, not on the basis of what group the individual belongs to. So people come forward, all of these good Germans, and every one of them has his decent Jew. Of course, it's quite clear that the others are pigs, but this one is a first-class Jew. Of all those, Himmler says, of all those who speak this way, not one has looked on, not one has lived through it. Most of you know what it means when 100 bodies lie together, or 500 lie there, or if 1,000 lie there. To have gone through this, and at the same time, apart from exceptions caused by human weakness, to have remained decent. That is what has made us hard. Well, you can read the rest of it. It's extremely disgusting. But don't you see, if 1,000 lie there, you understand that what they are. They're like, as I mentioned before, in many of the documents, the railway documents, of transports going to the East with Jews, carrying them to the death camps of Operation Reinhardt or the big killing center and a concentration camp at Auschwitz. In these cases, many of the train people referred to the individuals on the trains as pieces, as simply Stücke. So this too is the totalitarian state in its practice, you might say. But I want to talk about economies a little bit now, and I just thought, you know, here's when we ought to say socialism. You have two cows, the government takes one and makes it illegal to sell the milk. Communism, you have two cows, the government takes them and denies they ever existed. Milk is banned completely. Fascism, you have two cows, the state takes both of them and sells you the milk. Nazism, you have two cows, the state leaves you one, takes the other, pays for the milk, and shoots you. Capitalism, you have two cows, you sell one and buy a bull. And the last one, I don't even have to read because we all know this, we live it every day. You have two cows. At first, the government regulates what you can feed them and when you can milk them. Then it pays you not to milk them. And then it takes both, accidentally kills one, milks the other, and pours the milk down the drain. Then it requires you to fill out the forms accounting for the missing cows. Okay, well, this is the unfortunate situation of the case. And there are many more of these, by the way. I'm sure you know many more than these. But this is a kind of, I don't know, a kind of personalized version that I like to use. Anyway, we can compare these total economies. We can look at Italian fascism, I think, as what I suggested at the beginning of failed corporatism, that ends in a prototype of the Western corporate welfare state. The Western, when I say corporate welfare, I mean our own state, our modern interventionist, semi-socialist, étatist state that we have in the West, where corporations are given the advantage insofar as they are closer to the centers of power, that is to say, where they are able to engage in rent-seeking most effectively, and then those subventioned, advantaged, specially supported elites, the anathema of real liberalism in the 19th century, the unequal support of a certain elite. Then when that happens, then they're able to call the shots and even change government policies if something doesn't work out right. And this is what corporatism in Mussolini's world looked like. You know, I described this before as this kind of organic thing where the government kind of shapes life by being the referee among all the different interests. But what it actually turned out to be in Italy was just simply this, a kind of analog or prototype for the welfare state in the Western world. So the interesting thing is that, or one of the interesting things about this is that Mussolini is condemned by people who have no idea how the country actually ran. It actually ran in exactly the way that modern sort of Keynesian socialists like to run their states. It's exactly the same thing. So that's, I think, how we can classify fascism. I think we can classify Stalinism, and we've studied this already, but I think we need to look at it as a brutal Neverland. I mean, it was a system whose very economic premises led to the deaths of millions or tens of millions, misery and privation for generations of people. It set back a whole part of the world, a whole rich civilization for who knows how long. I mean, we have no way of calculating where that cultural investment would have taken place, and left a kind of scorched earth over that land. And so many of these things, so much of the collectivizing the farms crisis, the artificial famine, it's just directly Stalin's version of economics, where he says, well, you know, we have all these richer people, and if we let them go on, then that'll be to the detriment of the country. And we have to get the 5-year plan going, and we have to move forward on this. It's all in his mind just an economic kind of calculation. But of course, he didn't know anything about economic calculations. At least he didn't internalize anything. He had apparently done some reading on this, but had not internalized it. So it's this kind of never land that we've talked about before, a system of quotas and propaganda for the workers and Stochovism and all of that. Well, how does Germany compare with these other two? Well, I think we can view Nazi Germany as a kind of Darwinist statist jungle in which confiscation is just basically continually redefined to mean anything that the state wants. Not so far from the others in this respect, especially Stalinism. But people do, under Nazism, have the illusion that private property continues. It's just that if the state wants your property, it just condemns you as a criminal in some way. and it is also true that you can kind of hang on to your goods in most cases with higher confiscatory taxes, in some cases, and with a kind of inflationary process, which is of course a transfer of wealth. But I mean, you can hold on to some of your wealth if you just keep quiet about everything. If you just go to the right party meetings and do the right things and hail Hitler at the right time. There is a way that you can kind of work in this jungle according to its own own jungle laws. But within Nazi Germany, just pretty much anything can be justified by the war for national efficiency. This reminds me of the T4 program, which I think I might have mentioned last week as a precursor in the Holocaust, but it's you certainly know about it. It's the killing of these innumerable innocents by the Nazis in a program started in just after the war began in 1945 to kill off people with congenital diseases, congenital handicaps, people who were classified as useless eaters in some way or other, people who were hopelessly insane, and those people were just gassed and removed from the face of the earth. And indeed, there were many people in that. As usual with any government program, it got both sloppy and overly enthusiastic. And there are now plenty of stories that have emerged, even in recent times, about people who were sent to be gassed and you know, after that lived long, productive lives. They weren't in any way handicapped at all. It's just that the state managed to tell their parents if they let them kill this institutionalized child that they would allow them a better flat or whatever. So everything could be justified by that, including putting people into concentration camps, including all the privations of the population, including the shooting people for defeatist talk, and including all the measures. So this too sounds fairly familiar to us these days. I mean, so many of these things really begin to sound familiar. If you're not worried yet, then maybe you should read some of this material more carefully. Well, in any case, you know, I wanted to start bringing in, by the next time we'll talk a lot more about Mao Zedong and Mao Zedong, or however you would like to hear it pronounced. I can't do it in any authentic way, but we used to say Mao Zedong when I was growing up, and now I understand it's Mao Zedong or something close to that. So I'll call him Mao, and we'll all just know who I'm talking about. But we do need to look at Mao and all this, because when you come right down to it, he's the biggest totalitarian of all in the most improbable situation. He's this Chinese son of peasants who gets some education, who gets into revolutionary situations before World War I, who then joins the Communist Party and becomes a kind of tool of the Comintern, the Communist International, and learns at the feet of Stalin, and eventually sets up a Soviet state in Western China. And then from there expands out to become the leader of Red China. His problem, of course, was that whereas, as we saw last week in some detail, that classically Marx, Lenin, Stalin, everybody sort of in his heritage thinks that the quote, idiocy of rural life is pretty much the worst thing that can exist. They all hate the peasants because the plan is for the proletarians to rise up. So it's both a functional and an intellectual feat to be able to say, well, here's a country, China, which is almost totally peasant. And especially in the parts we're taking over at the beginning, and we have to figure out how to apply all this to the peasants. So what this requires is a careful study by Mao of methods of terrorism, and then with the help of some terror invented by himself and his henchmen, He's able to take advantage of the war situation to take over China. But I say all that to say this, that if we put Mao on this scale, I think we'd find some interesting things too. In the original version of Mao's communism, especially communism riding high, communism as as it first takes over all of China just after the war, then what we see is a kind of war communism, very much like the original Soviet war communism, where everything is accounted as property to be shared out. I mean, you don't have a little copper brooch that's not taken away, or that couldn't be at least theoretically used to get you executed. But on the other hand, you could also get executed because of who you are. You may just belong to a class where they do happen to have some brooches, and if they're guilty, you're guilty. So that's the way that works. The economy goes into an absolute spin. It's like Neverland in peasant land, and it leads to dreadful privations for many, many years, and only gradually becomes a kind of industrial-based movement as we go along. But that too, I mean, Mao too is someone we need to start considering at this point. Let me turn now to the crimes of the totalitarians and the nature of those crimes and the shape of the state. I've already mentioned the functionalist versus intentionalist debate, and I want to emphasize again that the roles of Himmler and Goebbels and many more were really, really crucially important. And the more we know about all this, the more we know about Himmler's actual early work in advising Hitler on how to create this state. There's a famous book from the 1970s, the early 70s, called The SS State, and it's the premise of the book. It's by a German historian, and it's the premise is that the whole Nazi state was really the SS state, because the SS, this police empire that included the Gestapo, that included the local police, that included the various kinds of security police and Heimat police, you know, the homeland police, that this SS was really at the center of the whole conception and the whole activity of the Third Reich. Edward M. Peterson was an American historian who died just recently, but wrote in the 70s a book called The Limits of Hitler's Power, and it's Peterson who really put a lot of these ideas into sync with each other, and actually concentrating on a kind of polycentrism within Hitler's power structure. Hitler liked competition. I mean, in this, Hitler and the nature of the state of the Third Reich were so totally different from Stalin. Hitler really had the conception that leadership should be sort of fought for, that that you shouldn't just have one person working on a problem. You should have three teams, and whichever team got there first, that's the team that would be the most hardened in the fire of competition, etc. And so for any given problem, say for example the occupation of Paris, for that problem you'd have competing competencies in there, competing offices there to run the show. So you might have the military governor of Paris, occupied Paris, and think, well, then that's all in hand. That general runs things. But not really the case. But the SS also had a man in there who was the SS commander for Paris and was constantly pushing against the prerogatives of the military governor. And that's not the end of it, because you also had a very independent Luftwaffe presence there. You also had some of Speer's people there. You had people from the munitions ministry who had top priority, top billing from Hitler. In many cases, they sort of won out and had the go-ahead. So all these people and more were competing with each other for the kind of go-ahead look. You could go through the same little train of thought in, for example, in that gouvernement général, that general government in Poland that we talked about the last time, and the extent to which there are five or six, there's not just one czar there, there's five or six or seven different individuals, different offices, who are really battling it out to get their policies accepted. So Edward N. Peterson says, this is polycentrism, and in a sense represents a limitation to Hitler's power that Hitler preferred. Well, if we then, in a way, this is part of what's expressed in that reading from Leviathan that you did, this famous book from one of the Frankfurt School scholars. And the issue there is that you've got all of these different agencies within the Third Reich. The economics of the Third Reich was totally integrated with this kind of SS state. In fact, the SS had businesses. And on the other hand, businesses which did not belong to the state were partly controlled by the state, partly subventioned by the state, and that there is this disorganized organization of the state where all the agencies are competing. And the point that the author is making is that this is, it's as opposed to the kind of Leviathan that Hobbes talked about, that the Hitler state was more of a behemoth, a different kind of monster, a different kind of huge being made up of all these different intentions and different elites and different groups battling against each other. It's also important to realize, of course, those Frankfurt School thinkers were all Marxists or something like that, and I think why the continuing popularity of all that generation of scholars in Germany in the Frankfurt School. But that's an example of one of those. The nature of Stalinist crimes and the shape of the state. As I mentioned at the beginning, Stalin also had his minions. I mean, we think of many of them along the way, and some of them long term. I mean, there are people like Yagoda and Yezhov who were short term only and got purged themselves. But you know, there are folks like Molotov and Brezhnev who were enthusiastic supporters of Stalin from one end of their lives to the other. From coming up in the party under him, they were those people that he signed into the party as party secretary, and they remained true to him even after he died, even after he'd been denounced by Khrushchev in 1956 and all that. Molotov, you can tell from that interview, he still had that heart for Stalin because Stalin knew what was happening. Stalin knew what should be done. Stalin knew what the best Marxist-Leninist thing to do would be. Well, this is really important, and the party enthusiasm there is also related to this. It is quite clear that there was a kind of esprit in among Stalinists that one can compare to the Hitler people, and I think it's not so easy to compare to Mussolini. I mean, certainly the black shirts were quite enthusiastic, but I don't think that Mussolini gave as much thought to penetrating society in the ways that Hitler did, certainly not in the way that Stalin did. But from the the young communists, the Komsomols, the young pioneers, all of the various youth groups, all of the, there's a huge emphasis on youth and newness, and a lot of these young individuals, young married couples, decided to devote their lives to Stalin and so forth in the 1930s, seeing this as a kind of surrogate religion, the religion of Stalinism, Leninism, or something like that. And then many of those people, of course, got purged. But those are exactly the types of people who remained true believers all the way beyond their, I mean, they survived the concentration camps, as I mentioned before, that book by Evgenia Ginzburg, in which in the end she says, and you know, I didn't do any of those things, but it was just the wisdom of the party that made it good for me to be in those concentration camps for 15 years. So there's a real enthusiasm that goes with this. It's not that everybody was on the business end of the Stalin regime. There were a lot of people helping him from the other end carry out the business of this vicious party. And to tell you the truth, some of that enthusiasm, I think, helps account for modern Stalinism, adulation or something. There are some American professors and a few more people who are Stalinist apologists who have big websites ready to show you how Stalin really was just a very decent man who was constantly being beset on all sides, that he was not as paranoid, that in fact he did have a lot of enemies. So I think that's part of this enthusiasm. You know, if things may be going wrong here, but if Stalin only knew, he would correct it. There's actually quite a similarity there to Hitler. There's a it used to be that people in Germany would say, well, you know, if Hitler only knew, then this little situation we have here wouldn't be taking place, whatever it was. A friend of mine who's a historian mentioned this to me a long, long time ago. And, you know, it did come up when I was in Germany in the 80s that people would say, yeah, well, things were horrible down here in Austria. That Kaltenbrunner, the party leader here, he was horrible. He was like a little dictator. Boy, if Hitler had only known that. So there's this sense that if the dictator only knew, then things would shape up. That all these things that are happening here are just mistakes. It's like when you say, well, you know, the government is good if the government only knew what was happening here in this local situation or something of that nature. I mean, the problem is the power, right? I mean, it's that's the problem, whether it's on high or on low. And so these problems will certainly exist. So, I don't know, we look at Stalin and one of the parts of the nature of Stalin is crimes, these horrific crimes, just crimes that you can't even imagine, the show trials and the collective guilt and the ethnic cleansing, more extensive than anybody in history, by far. The forced collectivization, which killed somewhere between 6 and 9 million human beings, starved them to death, killed them with typhus as a result of the poor conditions, all of that. I mean, you just go on, and it's an awful lot of crimes. It's more, and the economic system, as we've seen, is more than mere misery. And so why don't people just go at it? Why don't people just take off after him in the, I say here, why don't they go Etienne de la Boitie on the state, on Stalin, on whoever's in charge? Well, of course, the fact of the matter is that some did. There was a lot of resistance in Soviet Russia in the beginning, especially on the part of peasants. There was a protest. There were peasants who just simply would not collectivize. They'd be hauled to the collective farm and they'd leave the next week when they could get back to their place. But eventually, the state terror that Stalin pushed out to the peripheries of the system was just so great that people it just turned into a bad bargain. I mean, if it's a certainty that you're going to get your whole family tortured and killed, or tortured and sent to work camps, never seeing any of them again, and all be killed, then it's just not worth it. So these total states, and indeed any state, has a real hold on people. But that's not the whole story, because people can rise up and kill them. And in certain places, they certainly did. I think the important thing here is that you get in both of these big regimes, and to a lesser extent in fascist Italy, and to some extent not very much at all in Leninist Russia before he had figured this out. He had figured the sort of public relations angles and propaganda angles here. I think that these individuals, Hitler and Stalin, figured out that you have to, if you're going to have a dictatorship that's supported by masses of people, that you have to give them the bread and circuses. You have to have a positive thing that people are identifying with. And certainly these youth groups are a positive thing. I've mentioned before they had great soccer teams, they had great club meetings, they had great all kinds of things. These parades were fun. You know, you read the memoirs of people who were in the Hitler Youth, and the parades were really fun for these kids. And they associated everything with the great leader, and they were taught to admire him and indoctrinate him. There's this real enthusiasm and that kind of glassy-eyed admiration. So there's certainly that. That's really important to people. And this then gets to be so much a part of the later totalitarian experience that we're going to talk about the next time. So you get to, for example, Ceausescu in Romania, a kind of latter-day imitation totalitarian like that, and it's all fun and games. It's all show. I mean, people are they can't eat. They're all hungry. There's nothing in the stores. It's a totally bankrupt, horrific system. But on the other hand, they have huge pageants all the time honoring Ceausescu and his wife, comrade scientist, madam comrade scientist of the country and all that stuff. So there is this kind of positive sort of propaganda aspect that these totalitarians, especially the two big ones, gave a lot of thought to. They obviously thought about what Mussolini had done, and they improved on that. I mean, you could almost say here's another connection of these many connections that we're seeing, direct connections between these totalitarians, and that is that Stalin, in some ways, is like Lenin plus Mussolini, where he takes the propaganda aspects, the military aspects, the militaristic kind of approach, with Lenin's collectivist and terrorist policies. So there's that to think about for sure. So a couple of final points here before we stop for our question and answer period. I don't know, Ed, on the toward the end of Omnipotent Government, page 242, Mises talks about, if I have the right version here, I may have had those notes from a different version. I guess I do. Mises, close to the end, talks about the dictatorship complex, the neurotic's dream. Every socialist wants his own socialism, not the other fellows, and there's this kind of neurotic desire for power, and that's obviously part of this. I mean, all of these guys that we've studied so far are neurotics, for sure, and they are people who personally lust after power, but they also have these huge, big systems that they're able to create. They're all extremely, all these men, Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, they're all extremely capable individuals, and the caricaturization of these men in wartime American propaganda cartoons and in kind of the myths of all this, and the kind of looking at Stalin as this guy who was so paranoid he couldn't even make a move. I mean, these things are just a misrepresentation. These weren't high-functioning neurotics who had an extreme addiction to power, and who, because of the conditions of the 20th century and the worship of the state that had come about anyway, it's these guys who are able to take the place. I mean, I'm almost standing Marxism on its head if I say, if it hadn't been Hitler, it would have been somebody else. That's actually exactly what the Marxists said about Hitler in the 30s. Well, if it hadn't been him, it had been somebody else. He's a representative of the bourgeoisie, and if not him, then somebody else. And I think they're right, but not for that. They're right for the wrong reason. I think that the state system of power produced this situation into which your Hitlers, your Stalins, your Mao's, all those people could step. So we have gone for an hour and 2 minutes at this point, and I think it's a chance to stop and talk about whatever you would like to talk about. We've just got nine of us here, but it's just about the same folks we have every time, and you're a bunch who ask really good questions, and so let's leave it on a more interesting picture here. I believe that's my last one, but let's leave it on something like that, and I'll give you a chance to gather your forces, and let's talk about some important issues here. By the way, were there ever any jokes that I told? I mean, you know, I told you I had a joke, and somebody asked me to tell it, and I said I would tell it later. Did I ever tell that? I can't remember. I mean, I kind of ruined it by saying I have a joke, you know, but still and all. No? Okay. Well, from the Soviet Union. And of course, the important point with this humor is that people have to make it through their life some way. I mean, under these kinds of events, and we know this today when we get frustrated with TSA, and we get frustrated with the police, and we get frustrated with the socialism of this, that, and the other. I mean, a joke kind of takes the edge off a little bit. But jokes really flourish in these regimes. So Brezhnev got up out of bed. He stretches, goes to the eastern. He has sort of windows on three sides. His room is, you know, kind of projecting. And he goes to the eastern side. And raises the blinds and looks out in the sun, says, "Hail, O glorious comrade, leader of the Soviet people." And Brezhnev nods to the sun in reply. So Brezhnev goes to work, and he takes a break for noon, and he goes to the northern facing window, and looks out, and the sun says, Hail, great leader of the Soviet Union and preserver of Soviet virtue. And Brezhnev says, well, yeah, okay, very good. Nice, nice to see you, son. And goes back to work. So he works until late. The sun's going down. He walks to the window and raises the blinds. He just sees the sun there hanging above the horizon. And he waits. Nothing happens. He waits. Nothing happens. And finally, Brezhnev just got frustrated, and he said, well, look, I open the blinds of the east window. You greeted me very well. I opened the blinds in the northern window. You greeted me very well. And now I open the blinds. You don't say a word. And the sun said, go to hell, Brezhnev. I'm in the west now. This is hard without any personal response, but I'll just play like you're all laughing hilariously. Did I mention the folks who had the, well, thank you, Cam. That's nice. I mean, that's not like roaring laughter, but that's okay. It was funny. Or like the guy who came home one day and just walked in the front. Well, it's the Soviet, you know, it's Soviet Union, and things are kind of grim. But he gets home to his family and hangs up his coat, and his wife rushes in, says, "Oh, Pavel, something horrific has happened." He said, "What's that?" She said, "Our parrot has escaped." And he says, "Oh no!" He grabs his coat and rushes out the door. He rushes down the street, sprints nearly all the way to Dzerzhinsky Square. And he goes into the KGB offices, and he walks up to the counter. And he says, the person says, "Yes." He says, "I'd like to report a missing parrot." And the man behind the counter says, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you, you know, this is the KGB, and we really don't deal with matters like this. But you can go to the police, the regular police. They're down the street. Maybe they'll be able to say something about your parent." The man says, "Oh, no, sir. Excuse me. You don't understand. I just want to tell you, in case you do catch my parent, I do not share its opinions." Now, see, that wasn't bad, but you're not even laughing. I know you can't laugh from across the airways. Okay, thank you, Charles. Thank you. There's an LOL. Now, see, that's what I'm talking about. LOL. Okay. Well, I'll stop with the jokes now, and maybe I'll think of a couple more next time. So, let's go with some serious questions about all this. Oh, here's a good. It's a serious question. With many of the articles, there are comments regarding the surprise felt by some Westerners over the failure of the Soviet Union. Yeah. Two questions about this. Why the seemingly universal surprise? And two, are there articles and books detailing this phenomenon in more depth? Oh, that's a good question. And I can answer the first a little bit better than I can answer the second. You know, I think that from before World War I, there was this a movement in Western civilization that sort of degraded the accomplishments and achievements of European liberal civilization and Western liberal civilization, and I think it came mostly from Auguste Comte. I don't think all that many people were enamored of Marx, but a lot were enamored of Comte, the American progressives, for example, and a lot of folks who just wanted a top-down, leadership-heavy kind of society. I mean, I'm sure you all have heard of Woodrow Wilson's alter ego, Colonel House, and the book that he wrote, Philip Drew, Administrator. It's a wretched book, but it illustrates the extent to which these guys thought that the wave of the future and the exciting kind of way that civilization would go on was in this age of positive knowledge of society, that it could be engineered and run in all these beneficial ways for the grubby masses, who wouldn't have to be grubby anymore because they'd all be told what to do. So there's, I think, this enthusiasm, and I think the war brings home this to people. It brings home to people, to these intellectuals and these elites, it brings to them some idea that, well, now this can be accomplished because the old system is dead. I'm sure you all know about the American educationist, progressive educationist, that Dewey himself welcomed the war. He said, you know, we can go much farther in wartime than we ever could before. So I think the war promoted this. There's a German individual, Richard von Mullendorf, and he's got a terribly long and complicated name. It's W-I-C-H-A-R-D. This is all his last name. Von, V-O-N, and then Mullendorf, M-O-E-L-L-E-N-D-O-R-F. And this guy comes out of the war. He's an economic sort of controller in World War One, and he becomes this crucial kind of sage in the German bureaucracy during the Weimar Republic because he's in favor of this, of a new wave. He keeps calling it a third wave, not the old conservatism or liberalism, not even Marxism, but a third way, an administrative kind of thing. So there's a lot of emphasis on experiments, and especially top-down experiments, and I think that a lot of these Western intellectuals, they all called the Soviet Union the great experiment. Many of them went over there and saw what they wanted to see, and were also given a kind of Potemkin view of the Soviet Union. I mean, they thought they were seeing, they thought they were seeing this picture right here. I mean, they thought that this was all for real, you know. And if they'd gone to Germany, they probably would have thought that was for real. But they just thought that there was this great enthusiasm and that people really were at the show trials. I mean, there were articles written in New York newspapers where these savvy New York journalists went to Russia and said, wow, people here are so invested in the great experiment that when they do bad things, they actually just confess all just spontaneously. Well, of course, the people confess because they've been tortured, these savvy New York journalists just drank it up. So that's a part of it. I mean, I think that they that there was this sense that in the that the great experiment would somehow work, and there might be problems and everything, but there might be the wrong people in there, but eventually, you know, it would be the universal ownership of property and universal love and all these crazy things. Although, I mean, anything to do with love in the Soviet Union is pretty far-fetched in terms of individuals. Now, are there many books dealing with it? Not very many, except, there is in the Black Book of Communism, there's a good section on that. In the introduction to Robert Gelatelli's book, Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler, he treats that just a little bit. But to tell you the truth, Laura, there are not very, very many places that I know of that treat that. David Gordon probably knows some places where one could go to find that, where intellectuals have discussed this. Paul Gottfried has written a lot about the Western intellectuals and their relationship to the Soviet Union, and so there might be some parts of his writings. It occurs to me there probably are that you could consult. But that's a tough one. I mean, it's not something that people have just naturally gone to. Well, I mean, partly because there's still kind of denial that that people were ever duped by all this. And once the Soviet Union was over, certainly everybody played like they had known things were bad all along. Okay, so Peter Magula, who knows all about totalitarian system from personal experience, two men in the prison. First one says, "Why are you here?" Second one, "For laziness." "Don't tell me this rubbish. No one gets in prison for laziness." "Well," he says, "me and my neighbor were talking political jokes, and I went to sleep. And I determined to denounce him in the morning, and he went to the KGB and denounced me the same evening. So it was laziness after all." I like that one. I like that one. You know, that reminds me of somebody in the last phase of the German Democratic Republic, the DDR, the Communist Germany, East Germany, before the wall fell. And these two guys meet. Alexanderplatz U-Bahn in Berlin, and they're, you know, sort of know each other, and they meet, and one of them says, "You know, I want to ask you, what do you think of Erich Honecker?" That's of course the dictator of East Germany. And the other one looks around and he says, "Shh, follow me." And so they go down to the subway. They take the subway out to over to Friedrichstrasse railway station, S-Bahn station. They transfer to the train. They ride out. They go nearly to the Czech border. They get out the last little town there. They look around carefully. He looks around carefully, leads his friend out into the middle of the field, and says, "Personally, I don't have anything against him." Okay, let's see. Cam says, "In my war studies, I came to understand that Hitler's generals or command staff had semi-control of their duties, and any attempt at cooperation had a tendency to stall or break down. All decisions must be made by Hitler in order for anything to move, unlike the Allies' business model structure." Well, okay, here's the thing. Here's the way I would put this on the military side, Cam. I would say, the way I see it, Hitler didn't pay constant attention he hardly paid constant attention to anything. He was a very bohemian kind of a guy. He was like like the person in Peter's joke. He was a little bit lazy. He liked to watch movies late into the night, get up at 12 or 1 o'clock the next day. But on the other hand, he got really totally committed and excited. He'd have one of these big ideas, you know, like when he banged his fist on the table to his generals and said, "The Ardennes, that's where we'll attack." And so the Battle of the Bulge came out of that. So he had all these bright ideas and, you know, really wanted to be the greatest military commander of all times. They made a little acronym for that. It didn't sound very good, but he did have these ideas. But on the other hand, he didn't follow those up very much. Now, when it was a specific thing, when it would come to his attention, for example, in Russia, where it made absolutely no sense from a military standpoint during the war, Hitler decreed that the German army should never give up one foot of territory, that they should always hold on to every square inch. Well, that made some sense if you were fighting a kind of a, you know, World War I Western Front war. You know, you don't want to give up too much. It's a stalemate anyway, and everybody. I mean, it doesn't make real sense, but it does at least have a kind of logic in that situation. But on the Eastern Front in World War II, where there was so much space, there was room for maneuver. This would be tantamount to saying to a soccer player, never go backward. Always only move toward the goal or hold your position on the field. In other words, soccer players have to use the space. That's the soul of the game. But Hitler had this kind of thing. Now, is that to say that no German general ever was able to maneuver? No. But where Hitler was, when he was paying attention, when his notice had been captured by the newspaper headlines or by somebody's worried report, or one of his other minions came up and said, you know what General so-and-so is doing in west of Kharkov? He's maneuvering. He's not holding onto the ground. He's pulling back so he can go around the side of the... Then Hitler would intervene. And then, of course, it was down to the details. Everybody had to kind of snap, too. But on the other hand, there were many cases where he just didn't pay much attention. And I think even for something like the Battle of the Bulge, it was just the German army was pretty much the German army, which had this tradition of pushing responsibility toward the bottom. So there was a lot of that, even so, even in spite of Hitler's critique of the command decisions. Yeah, it's a good question. He wasn't quite as much the kind of, I don't know, you'd say social Darwinist or something in that regard. But de facto, he was part of the time, because he simply just didn't have the attention span. And of course, nobody had the ability to pay attention to all the details in leading a country. So you just can't do that kind of micromanaging. I hope that's some kind of answer, Kim. Lee says, Hunt, I just wanted to let you know that I picked up Dennis Sereny's book, Into That Darkness, as well as your book. Well, thank you very much. Dennis' book is fantastic. Yours is very good as well. Thank you very much. I appreciate the comment. I think I can promise you that Gitta's book is way more fantastic than mine, but I like mine too. But Into That Darkness, that'll keep you awake at night. So anyway, good luck with getting into that. Kim says, and we're back referring back to that question, yeah, it seems that when the Army needed the Air Force could give the cold shoulder until Hitler made a response. And that's really true. And in a way, Hitler did make those decisions, but he just had people battle it out first, and then he'd give the nod. You know, my first work on Nazi Germany many, many years ago was, when I was doing my master's thesis, had to do with German economics and the way they were making synthetic fuel and the planning for war self-sufficiency and things like that. And, the economic advisors came and went. And there's a period there where Hjalmar Schacht, the old Reichsbank president from the Weimar Republic, was running policy as Secretary of the Treasury. And then at the same time, Hitler had an economics minister, Eckert Kehr, I'll think of his name in a minute, who was actually totally the opposite to Schacht, and they had these totally opposing policies. And then in the midst of this, Hitler appointed Goering as the head of he created the four-year plan, 1936. In the midst of that discussion, put Goering as the head of it, but also other important individuals over different parts of the four-year plan office. And so, and that's just the beginning. I mean, there's the military economics offices and all kinds of things. And so there's this huge, big competition, and eventually Schacht gets disgruntled and leaves, and then the economics minister is put in another job, and the military takes over this and that. So it's a kind of a sorting out, and Hitler helps with the sorting out, but it's after there's been the competition. So that's similar. I mean, as you say, there are times when Goering just won't cooperate, or the Air Force people, the Luftwaffe people just won't cooperate, and then Hitler has to come in. Let's see. Matthew says, Mackey says, do you think a precondition for totalitarian rule is societal and economic breakdown prior to the acceptance of a dictator? In other words, did Germany, Russia, China all see significant moves backwards economically relative to their prosperity at the time before the periods of totalitarian rule? And I think that's, I think that's a great and excellent point, Matthew, and I agree with your premise there wholeheartedly. All you have to do is think of the disaster of two big wars for Russia, the Russo-Japanese War, 1904-1905. Russia hadn't quite recovered from that economically, and it didn't have an open market system in any case, so it was really hard to, it had a firm currency, but not an open system or a free market. And so Russia had certainly not recovered from the first of those two wars when the First World War actually started. And yeah, Russia was an economic basket case already by the end of 1916, and so and they had their inflation and all the interventions into the economy and all that. So it certainly was. Germany in exactly the same way, or not exactly the same way, but in a similar way, hollowed out by World War One, actually damaged by the national income tax in 1910, and taxed much higher to create the German Navy. Inflation starts before World War One. It continues to rise during the war. Then after the war, 1920, the inflation goes double digits, and then even more, and then in the process goes hyper, and the usual scenes that we know from post-war Germany. So yeah, there's certainly that. China is in a similar case. I mean, China was just an economic basket case from this a series of civil wars that really. Even predate the Chinese Revolution, before World War One, and move on to the future. So yeah, I would say that's right. I'll say this too. Also, Matthew, I think that so many things come from wars. I think that ethnic cleansing, that you can pretty much make that an attendant of economic. Disaster and collapse associated with wartime too. I think that that's pretty much a precondition for that too, and that these things are not, of course, not mutually exclusive in any way. In fact, they tend to go together. Yeah, that's a good, very good point. Good point of comparison. So Lee says, how much of the Soviet technological developments were stolen? Western technology, and how much did they actually develop? Well, I don't, Lee, that's a good question. I don't have any numbers for it. Of course, the big work on this is Anthony, who's going to tell me the name of that author? It's late in the day. It's Anthony Sutton. And so, Anthony Sutton is the author of two-volume work, Western Economic Development in the Soviet Union. And Sutton's work shows pretty definitively, this is now 40 years old, but showed pretty definitively in the 70s when it was written that that much of Soviet technology was stolen. Well, I mean, you've got to wonder how a country could develop technologically if there is no market, and if there is no if the government is there's not a huge market element in the Nazi Germany economy. There is some, but even so, then they have much more of an economic buffer, and the government research institutes are in place, and there's this kind of government element. So you can see how they could develop something. But it would be hard to think of that crazy government set up, that horrific government that's so busily killing people, taking away grain from the fields, and all of that, that throughout the whole period of the 20s and 30s, how they could suddenly come up with huge technological developments. Now, of course, there were plenty of great Soviet engineers and Russian engineers and Russian scientists. But on the other hand, Stalin pretty much wiped out all the engineers in the early 30s. That was one of the first groups to go in the Great Purge. They were all called wreckers, the whole group of engineers who had a kind of social identity in the old Russia. They were all kind of graduates of just a few technical universities, and they all considered their engineering a calling, and you know, that whole big bridge builder kind of mentality. And Stalin just thought, well, you know, they're out to get me, and so he had him killed. So in a country like that, it's hard to imagine that you'd have all these rapid technological developments. Well, there's the whole case of Trofim Lysenko, who rejected all of Mendelian physics. He was just a kind of wacko guy who said, well, you know, wheat in Russia is just not being grown properly because it's got say Mendelian physics. I meant Mendelian genetics, of course. But he's saying, you know, the old model of genetics is wrong, and the way you should grow wheat is this. And it was disastrous. But Lysenko became another Stakhanov. He became a sort of hero of the Soviet Union and head of all the agricultural development, and head of, certainly, he made it illegal to say anything except his theory in Soviet universities. And everybody knew he was wrong, except Stalin liked him. And so in a country like that, it's hard to imagine that there were huge, huge advances, anything like, you know, a sort of typical year in an American industrial city like Detroit or something. But then there's also the immediate reflex of the Russians in 1945 to take all of the German engineers they could find. Now, we did some of that too, but the Russians really, I think, took a lot more. In any case, I think I agree with Sutton on this. I mean, I think he's the authority, and I would certainly say that many of these things were stolen and or otherwise transferred to the Soviet Union. To run the new Soviet economy without money, you've got me there. From the beginning, they had a currency, but I don't know if Lenin, I don't recall. This sounds like something I used to know, but I don't anymore. So the economy without money. If somebody knows that in the group, please say it. I just can't think of that right now. Okay, Laura asks also, so if Western intellectuals, this is a follow-up to her earlier question, if Western intellectuals saw the Soviet Union as the great experiment, how did that morph to the Soviet Union being the number one enemy? What changed? It was born, I was born, sorry. I was born in 1983, so the Soviet Union as enemy was only encountered in history classes in school, and I find this dichotomy intriguing. Okay, yeah, that's an excellent question, Laura, and it's a fun one to talk about. Here's the thing. The modern accounts, in my view, the sort of, you know, what is taught in high school, and a lot of college classes too, tend to say that that everybody only sort of had it in for the Soviet Union, that the Cold War meant that all the intellectuals were kind of, you know, against the Soviet Union during that period of time. But I'll have to say, there was always a huge, huge, extremely substantial majority of intellectuals in the United States and in the West at large who liked the Soviet Union very well, still, even throughout most of the Cold War. And so, for example, you have people like Jean-Paul Sartre, who is just an out-and-out voice of Moscow in France. He's the great existentialist and also an enthusiastic supporter of the Soviet invasion of Budapest in 1956, etc. So there's still that tradition living on. He too thought it was a great experiment in 1956 and still in 1968. And the occasion of the Soviet put down of Prague Spring. So that kind of thing is still going on. But in America, there were plenty of intellectuals who just sort of said, well, you know, the Soviet has its downside, but we can all be friends, and why can't we all just get along? There was very, very little knowledge in American colleges and universities about the kind of crimes of Stalin that we've been talking about. Nobody, in my college career, nobody ever mentioned these crimes. The purges a few times in history classes, a few more things, but not very much. Almost nobody mentioned that religion was just simply wiped out in Lenin's Russia, and that it only survived by kind of going underground and then coming back. Nobody mentioned all these things. And so there was still this sort of intellectual tendency quite alive, in spite of the fact that the country, I mean, people knew that there had been the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they knew that some of them knew that there were Soviet weapons fighting against the Americans in Vietnam, maybe not that many. But both things were known. I'll have to say this, when Solzhenitsyn's book, and I believe I've mentioned this before in the course of this course, and I think it's an important piece of information. When Solzhenitsyn's book came out, and he won the Nobel Prize for A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, but then he followed that fame with the Gulag Archipelago first volume, which was 73 or 4, I can't remember. But this was a huge revelation and a huge discussion among professors. Many of them said, "Well, I just can't believe this." Students didn't know the book at all. I mean, students. I assigned the Gulag Archipelago for the first time to a class at the University of Virginia in, I don't know, maybe it was 1982. The year before you were born, Laura, I was already assigning Solzhenitsyn. And, you know, that I had students who wrote a paper on it. And in several of the papers, more than one and more than a few, people said, well, I can't believe this. I've never heard anything like this. I didn't know Stalin committed crimes. I didn't know that there was any downside to all this. So the idea that we could just sort of get along, that a kid from Connecticut or someplace who wrote to Brezhnev in the early 80s and said, you know, adopted a kind of Rodney King philosophy, why can't we all just get along, Mr. Brezhnev? And Brezhnev then invited him to come to Moscow, and the kid went, and when he came back, he told all about how he got to go on the roller coaster in Gorky Park, and the newspapers just went gaga. And this is at the same time that Lithuanian sailors were diving off huge cargo ships when they get into an American harbor, and there's a the old gag that we used to say at the time. I mean, this is original time. What do you call a Soviet quartet that makes an American tour? You call it a trio. Somebody would defect. So all these things are happening, and then there's a lot of denial and on the other side. It was not in any sense the way that there were total loggerheads. the liberal sentiment in America was always that, well, they mean well, this is a kind of experiment. They say they're for the people and we're for the people too. And there was that kind of sense of things. So I hope that helps explain that. I could talk for quite a while on this issue because I kind of lived through it. And I was in a family that was an old anti-Roosevelt family from way back. And so we had a lot of issues that we talked about in my family and books that, you know, that I had access to. And so I was kind of on the old right from you know, the time I was a little kid. So I paid attention in the 60s to these kinds of things, and certainly in the 70s when I was in college. So it makes sense. There's a kind of vapid. But if you look at this picture that we have in front of us, there is this kind of romance to all this. There is this kind of spiritualism for all of it. It really is a surrogate religion, and I think this is important. I even talked to people in East Germany just before the wall fell in 1989, and there really was this sense. Well, you know, we don't have anything here. We really don't produce much. Everybody needs something. Goods are short, in short supply. You know, you run out of everything all the time. But, you know, we think that we have this collectivist society and that this makes us all better somehow. There's this kind of spiritual, there was a kind of self-satisfied character to that. And I think that was also part of the West, that there was this kind of feeling, well, you know, everything here is just about making money, whereas in the Soviet Union, they don't care about making money. Well, they didn't care about the economy, that, for sure. I mean, they're only in a certain horrific way. So I think that attitude leaks back to. I hope that helps a little bit. And again, I like this question very well. It's one that's kind of haunted me through my life. Okay, from Peter to all participants. For example, the Soviets were taking whole factories away in the USSR as war booty from liberated countries. Czechoslovakia too. Nobody talks about that one, Peter. They all talk about East Germany, but not Czechoslovakia. In spite of that, the exiled governments of those countries were their ally. This is absolutely true. I mean, they were just everything the Soviets took over within the empire that became the satellite states. The Soviets ransacked those countries as well. Very good point, Peter. Thank you. And Charles says, and he's exactly right when he says, there was no capital market in the Soviet Union, no guidance for the structure of production. There's no way of calculating it. I mean, they just had no way. And it's compounded by the fact, I mean, it would have been one thing if there had been no calculation and they kept the records straight. But since all the records were just lies, because everybody had to lie because of their quotas, then that makes it even more difficult. It really was a basket case, and the black market is the only thing that kept people in food. I mean, even in even late in the Soviet Union in the 80s, somebody from a college I worked for took a trip of students, a group of students to Soviet Union in, I suppose it was 88 or so. And 87, and what had long existed was prevalent. People took a pair of blue jeans so that they could swap it for some little nesting dolls or something. And there is this black market. Everybody, all experts on Soviet food production thought that these little tiny little garden plots allowed behind one's house in of the Soviet agricultural collective system of kolkhozes and sovkhozes, these collective farms, And these little pots were what were producing most of the food for the country. So, no capital market, no way to figure out where to invest. But the way they did figure out, of course, Charles, was through the theory of, you know, Stalin's theory of concentration, heavy industry, and then you kind of go from there. From Leslie to could the disorganization at the top in regard to economic policy have helped the German economy? Less interference with the private sector because of the disorganization. You know, that's an intriguing question, and it's one that relates actually to a. This is a weird concurrence. You know, we talked about Gittes Sereni last week and this week too. But in her great book on Albert Speer and his struggle with truth, and of course Speer was Hitler's architect, who then became in 1942 the Minister of Munitions, and eventually was pretty much one of the most powerful guys in the Third Reich, and to some extent, I believe kept Germany in the war. I kept the German war effort going as long as it went. He gained in this kind of Darwinian way. He gained huge power to his group. They built all kinds of things all over the German Empire, all over the occupied countries, both military and kind of non-military. I mean, it was a huge operation, and he had a genius for it. I mean, he was a in some ways, very good. Well, anyway, in some ways, very, I don't mean to say very good. In some ways, he was as one of the most capable men in the government. And he gets into a discussion deep in the book, in Gittes Sereni's book. And maybe I mentioned this before, but I don't believe I did. He gets into this discussion with her, and it's where he actually mentions Hayek, and he says, you know, the thing is, there were so many stupid controls in Nazi Germany that I just hate them. We would have done much better if we had had a real market in operation, if we hadn't had all those regulations. He said, you know, the one who really gets it all right is Hayek. You know, if we had had a Hayekian economy, Germany could have just fought a lot better, and I could have built a lot more. And so it's this crazy moment when I read it, and of course I was so aware of Gittes Sereni and her connection as stepdaughter to Mises, and I thought, this must have been a very, very strange moment for her to hear Albert Speer, of all people, come out with this kind of pronouncement for libertarianism or something, which really wasn't. But and it may have been that he was disingenuous. He may have said that on purpose just for her. But I've thought about that a lot. So yeah, I mean, I think it did do that. I think there was disorganization in between the rules, and I think that Speer took advantage of that all the time, and that's kind of what he was talking about. And I think, face it, Ludwig Erhard, who became a student of Mises somewhere in this period, did work in German economic organizations during World War II. I mean, it's not like because he believed in free enterprise privately that he put it into his work and he went up against the authority and said, wait a minute, you shouldn't have these laws. I mean, he did what he could, and he was still, you know, he was working, and then in Germany, and then of course he came to the fore after the war and helped bring about the German economic miracle. So that's a part of the story too. I mean, he was there were some of those elements were in there. So I in principle, I think your question points toward something that's correct. I think the disorganization was almost helpful. And Cam writes the enigmatic comment, vodka and salted fish. Okay. What does that mean, Cam? I'm just not sure. I mean, just curious. So, from Lee K, to what extent did the Nazis launder money and gold taken from Jews through Swiss banks? A lot, Lee. the more we find out about it, the more it seems they did. It used to be we had a little bit different take on Switzerland and their neutrality, but one reason that, we thought it was the Swiss shaking their fist at the Germans and saying, you don't dare come in here, or that we thought it was the mountains and the mountain passes and closing the tunnels and things like that. And all that was part of it, but in fact, there was a lot of basically money laundering, a lot of gold that and wealth that went to Switzerland then that's undoubtedly there now. So yeah, there's some groups still kind of working on those issues, and their information is it seems pretty firm that there's still a lot there, and that there was a whole lot at one time. Oh. I see. Cam says the economy was based on vodka and salted fish, and that was just a joke. I get it. Yeah, that's funny. Let's see. Okay, so what questions do we have going now? Are we about to wind down? We really have gone nearly 2 hours. I went over last week and I felt a little guilty about it, although the discussion was really great. But the part that went over was actually my lecture. Any chance of having a further reading list or books that you would recommend to read? Yes, absolutely. Let me jot that down so that I'll begin putting that together. I think you've mentioned that before, and if not, then I'm just misremembering. But yeah. And you mean to read on topics related to all this? Sure. Yeah, I'll be glad to do that, and that'll be I'll put that in next time. By the way, there'll be a little bit of change next time. You will not see this familiar background with all these books behind me because I'm going to be in Binghamton, New York for the weekend, and I have to give a lecture from a motel there, and so I'll be actually in the Eastern time zone, so I've got to remember to start at the right time, and so I'll have a more bland background, but maybe I can figure out some cool background setting to put behind me in that hotel room. Anyway. Yes, I would. I'd be glad to put together a list of books, and I'll start and I'll get it to you by next week. Just one or two quick things for those of you who are still interested in the grading option. I know that a lot of you have had trouble kind of getting mobilized to do this. Go ahead and send those things in. And I realized that I didn't give out a test, or that I must have forgotten, it slipped my mind or something. And so I put two on there yesterday. We put two on yesterday. And if you want to grade, I mean, keep going. You start from the first if you want to. This is all for, it's not like you're learning lessons of character here. This is all just business and, trying to internalize as much and think about as much as you can. So if you want to do that, just go ahead and put them on their proper Moodle place. I think I'm just about caught up grading, and I'll continue to grade them. And, this can even go a little bit longer than the course. But if you want to do that, feel free, or if you want to email me and we'll talk about the payment plan or whatever. I'm kidding, but I mean, whether you might have a few days extra to do it or an extension. So anyway, that'll be the case. If that's the case, let me know. Let's see. Cam says, I concur with Laura. that, oh, I'm sorry. Sam says, besides next week being last class, any chance you'll be doing any more classes here sometime this year? Yeah, there's a possibility, and I've had a few ideas. It was a couple of years between my last two courses, but yeah, I have some more ideas, and I've had such a nice time doing this, and good response from all of you, and it's fun doing it. So I might do something later this year. I've been kind of thinking about it. So it's a distinct possibility. Let's see. Weeks ago you mentioned a book about the Poles and the Germans, and I was not able to find it. Charles, tell me, is that the Poles and Jews before World War II? I just can't remember that reference. Why don't you email me, Charles, and maybe I can think of this, or maybe somebody else who's listening can remember what the subject was. And Leslie says she'd be interested in taking the hyperinflation course if you teach it again. Yeah, that was a fun. That's a really good course. It's got a lot of great stuff in it. That's a real possibility. Let's see, Charles. Okay, I don't remember the book specifically, but do email me and remind me about this, and I'll think of a book too. To go with that. We can do that. I just don't know of any one particular book to tell you now, and I don't know what book I might have been talking about in there, but yeah, there's a couple, two or three places that will give you that information. Okay. Do we have anything else? If not, I guess we can conclude. Okay. Well, thank you very much then, and thank you very much. Excellent. And I think we will call it a day. I hope you have a nice Sunday evening or Monday morning or whatever it is that you're about to have, and I will see you next time, coming at you then from Binghamton, New York. Okay, bye-bye.